Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your fantastic voyage of music, news, and criticism. I am your New York City smoke show, John Caramonica.
Oh, friend, it's been a while. And I ain't spoke to you in years. And oftentimes, boys from this town will pull wheels down and disappear.
Sometimes I'm out on the road or I'm not in contact with people and people are like, where's John? Where are you? What are you doing? How come we haven't heard from you in a couple of days? And the answer is I am in Richmond, Virginia. I am in Indianapolis, Indiana, and I am in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, chasing the Zach Bryan story, which is what I was doing for a not insignificant portion of this summer. Zach Bryan, who you may know, has an album that came out a few months ago called American Heartbreak that debuted in the top 5 of the Billboard chart and has been hovering in the top 20 ever since. Also had a subsequent EP called Summertime Blues that is very good. At the beginning of the episode, what we were listening to is Oklahoma City, which is one of several really great songs on American Heartbreak. Zach Bryan is a .. country adjacent, folk adjacent, rock adjacent performer. He's a Navy veteran, incredible songwriter, really, really beautiful, rough-edged singer, and has been building an incredible audience online while he was still in the Navy and kind of came out of the Navy last year and arrived almost fully formed into playing to 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people a night. And now that number is crawling upwards. It is an interesting case study in, number one, how fandom is created on the internet. It's an interesting case study for the boundaries of country and what we think country is and what it actually is. It's also fascinating to be at these shows and see, frankly, young men singing along top volume verses and choruses, and not just in the front rows. I'm talking all the way in the cheap seats. A real thing is happening with Zach Bryan, and it's something that's not really on the radar, I think, of a lot of people. We did Popcast Live a couple weeks ago. Not that many people in the audience were up on him. It's not really hitting in the more traditional media centers, as you might imagine, but it is a extremely real thing, and Zach Bryan is doing some fascinating work, and I was really excited to be able to tell his story in depth. So we're going to get into Zach Bryan's backstory, a bit into his music, and there's really only one person we could do that with, and that's Grady Smith, country music YouTube king. Grady, what's good, man?
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Grady, first of all, of course, a pleasure. Grady also interviewed Zach in 2019, early. And this is when Zach was putting out independent record. I think Deanne, which was the first independent record, had just come out. And all of the progressive country music internet was agog. And Grady was on it early. Grady and I were going to get into a big conversation about what Zach's doing now, where he came from, and also, like I mentioned, some of the bigger picture questions about genre and audience that his success is kind of triggering. Grady, before we kind of go back to 2019, can we talk a little bit about the summer that Zach Bryan has been having right now with American Heartbreak and Summertime Blues? How surprised were you or are you about the persistent success of American Heartbreak?
I'm not surprised at all, to be honest. The best gauge for me is not any chart metrics, not any radio performance, none of that. It's just my DMs. Okay. Is how I can tell.
Me too, Grady.
Yeah, if people are happening and if there's genuine passion, their fans go out of their way. And for years now, there's no one that can touch Zach in terms of the sheer amount of messages I get about him. And I've covered him from the beginning for so long, and still probably the most common comment I get is, hey man, are you going to weigh in on Zach Bryan? And I don't know how much more I can do. I've been on it, but you can just tell, you can just feel it. There's something happening, just like you said.
I have some theories about this, but I'm curious about your theories before I impose mine. What do you think is setting apart this particular fandom from fans of other, whether we want to say progressive country, rough-edged folk, like folk rock, rocker folk, whatever, what is setting his fandom and the enthusiasm of this fandom apart from some of these other artists?
I think the populist aspect of it is a pretty huge factor. The way Zach's rise occurred with these pretty crappy I think at first just like iPhone videos that were popping off on Twitter. And then it led to still just very lo-fi. Maybe they were using a better camera, but lo-fi videos that were on YouTube. There was just this giant trove of content that was out there acoustically, very undecorated. And I almost think in the same way that you see Gen Z Instagram aesthetic is all about kind of crappy, blurry photos and photo dumps versus the over-filtered, over-perfect millennial aesthetic. I kind of think the same thing is maybe happening in music. And there is this draw to this trove of acoustic content. And I don't want to bury the lead here. I think Zach's an amazing and unusual songwriter.
I was very struck being at these shows, seeing oodles and oodles and oodles of young men, 20, 22, 24, singing along with the passion that you would see K-pop fans singing along, Taylor Swift fans singing along, Nicki Minaj fans rapping along. You don't see a lot of what really scanned to me as like male vulnerability and male intimacy. You just don't see a lot of it in live music, not that much. I was incredibly struck by that. And it made me think a lot about what's going into Zach Bryan's songs. What's the sauce in these songs that's triggering the safe space for these young men to really be expressing themselves through singing and through the shared experience of singing together. And when I was trying to kind of put my thumb on it, I think what it is what Zach Bryan writes about is both very small, intimate moments, but also this kind of like big picture sweeping generalization. There are these kind of anthemic ideas. And he talks a lot about Kerouac. He talks about it, you know, on his Twitter, and he talks about it in the interview with me. I think there's like a mythology that he's building one song at a time. And I feel like young men are buying into that and maybe even seeing themselves in it. That's how it kind of registered for me. And I wonder, what have you been picking up on?
I've seen the exact same thing. I actually call Zach fans sad boys. And that's what I call my own audience too. Like, YouTube's a very male platform, so I think I've experienced a lot of that as well. I think there's a feeling out there among a lot of young men of just they're not so good. And there's probably big reasons culturally that they might feel that way. But I do think Zach has a certain self-loathing nature in his writing that does feel like a bridge, I think, for a lot of people. The original song of his that popped off, the original song that I connected to, was Condemned. Which is literally, I'm condemned. That is such a brutal thing to say about yourself.
We'll dig up the original Twitter video of Condemned, which is out and about. We'll find it. We'll play a little bit of that right here.
I'm condemned. All my heart is on the mend. Looking for somebody just to save me. I'm condemned. Just like all my worthless friends. Waiting on the wind to set us free. Oh, the depth that I've been after, all the booze and all the laughter. I guess that's just what makes us who we are.
He's in the Navy. I'm not sure if he was on deployment. I can't quite remember where that video was filmed. But he's in the Navy, you know, working 8, 10, 12, 14-hour days. He works with ordnance, with weaponry. And at night is coming home and writing these songs and filming videos. And like, as you mentioned before, posting them to Twitter. And then suddenly that pops off out of nowhere. Twitter, a very bizarre path to success, really, for anybody in 18 or 19 when that popped off. Very bizarre. No one's really popping off on Twitter musically, but maybe that says something about the country music audience.
Honestly, I don't even know. I think it's random because he was also putting stuff on, I think, SoundCloud that no one cared about. And those YouTube videos go way back. So I think Twitter is just where it clicked. But it's funny to even think about putting videos on Twitter. But it certainly worked. And all those like guys out in the red dirt world, like all the Co Wetzels and the even Parker McCollum, there's this like style of Twitter where you just kind of almost treat it like free form poetry or something. You just say these kind of one-liners into the ether. Like if you're out at a bar, you might say, I don't know, you just might write a tweet that says, I'm lonely and the stars are so blue. And that's just your whole tweet or something. And for whatever reason, that scene does like Twitter.
I didn't know that was like a systemic thing with that scene.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So that's where Zach's picking up on it. Because obviously, I mean, we might as well just dive right into it, right? He's Red Dirt adjacent. He's like Turnpike Troubadours, an Oklahoma group adjacent. He's from Aluga, Oklahoma. I hope I have the pronunciation on that correct, which is about 30 miles from Tulsa. And maybe the money question is, despite what he insisted to me in our interview, he's country adjacent. I'm curious to hear what you have to say about this, because I think maybe there are changes or evolutions in what it means to be quote unquote country in this specific moment, 2022, where that's maybe a complicated thing for him to claim.
On Deanne, on his breakout album, line one of song one is, "We could find a porch to hold us where we could all scream Childers," referencing Tyler Childers. And so I think that's telling of kind of what scene he might consider himself in or is influenced by. And there has been this sort of alternative country scene that it's like a weird alliance, I think, of Appalachia and kind of Texas, Oklahoma, the Red Dirt scene. It's almost more divided along the lines of independent versus the mainstream country. Because now at this point, I feel like people talk about artists from Kentucky and West Virginia in the same breath as guys from Texas. But yeah, I think absolutely Zach is informed by all that stuff. And even early on when he was breaking out, he wrote a song kind of for Evan Felker when he was doing poorly and kind of in and out of rehabs and his marriage was falling apart and all that stuff. And some Turnpike fans got frustrated by that. But it was this very sincere plea of like, hey, we need you back because we love your songs, basically. I certainly would put him in that world. And definitely, I think he is sharing a fan base with these kind of outsider populist heroes of the country world, whether it's Whiskey Myers or Tyler Childers or Sturgill. It's the same type of people that love those types that are also obsessed with Zach.
And he spoke very affectionately of Sturgill's music, of Tyler Childers. He mentioned Gregory Alan Isakov, who's a little bit separate from this, but like was sort of living in this space a little bit as a songwriter. Grady, we've talked about this both on podcasts and also just outside of this, which is like there are some for whom being labeled country is like a four-letter word. And the struggle that I noticed in reporting the Zach story is there is definitely a segment of the audience. You know, there were Joe Biden chants in between the opener and Zach's set. And maybe in one case, kind of popping up during Zach's set. He says he wants to shut that down. He's trying to like say, don't bring that in this house. That's not what this is about. But I think there are some part of the fan base for whom whatever Zach is doing, as nuanced as it is, might be indistinguishable from what a more conventional right-leaning centrist country star is doing.
I personally don't view it from the spectrum of kind of right and left. I would view it more as kind of like establishment versus independent. I really think that is the spectrum that most country fans that I interact with seem to care about. And it's more the idea that Nashville is almost the, if we're going to put it in political terms, Nashville is almost the Washington, D.C. of of that sort of metaphor where people are like, oh, if it's coming from the big corporate established labels in Nashville that are just pumping out factory trash, then it's not good country and I don't want anything to do with it. That's how I see a lot of fans reacting. And definitely it's probably my kind of anti-establishment bias myself. I can understand why any artist wouldn't want to be thrown into one little box too strongly. It's almost like you have to keep, even if you don't mind the label, it's like you have to keep resisting the label so that you can feel free to do what you want down the road. Because I definitely see him, especially as it seems like in the last few years, he spent more time up in New York, almost more like this Joni Mitchell era. I see this kind of broader classic American Springsteen-y, Joni Mitchell-ish thing kind of brewing in his music. And his music, I will say, I still think it reads quite country. And when you look at his band, I mean, he's got amazing steel. He's got amazing fiddle. There's all these country instruments in it. And yet it's also brought in a lot more kind of heartland rock feel with a lot more percussion than was present on his first couple albums.
So I saw Zach play twice this week. And the reason we're recording it now is I wanted to record this episode after I had seen these two shows. And I saw him play, you know, like a normal size show at Pier 17, which is like an outdoor venue on the top of what used to be the South Street Seaport here in New York. It's a little bit, maybe a little too fancy for its own good. not connected to Zach at all, but just like a kind of like slightly over-polished venue, I think. But then he played a small acoustic show at the Bitter End, a venue I had not been to in 20 years, for maybe fan club people. I couldn't quite tell who the audience was. And basically, the accompaniment on that show was, I think, lap and fiddle, maybe like one additional guitarist on a couple songs. And in that context, especially, not that I have any trouble hearing the quote unquote countryness of his songs in other contexts, but certainly in that context, to emphasize that, to lean into that, it really felt potent. It almost felt like a statement in a way. Really wonderful show. If anybody bootlegged it, please send me the MP3s. I would love to have a copy of that for my personal archive. Going back to the Deanne era, actually, let's listen to Godspeed. So Godspeed is kind of like maybe the after Condemned, which is a, sort of the breakout Twitter hit. Godspeed is like the first signature Zach Bryan hit. So let's listen to Godspeed off of Deanne from 2019.
Well, I want to die an old man. Messed up stories of me and all my old friends. And laugh about how we all thought it won't end. How we all wind up where we began.
Now, in my conversations with him, this is a song that he actually had for a couple of years, even before Deanne came out. He'd been sitting on it as one of the first songs that he was like super excited about and super proud of. To do a song like this, like very early in your writing career, I don't know. I find it to be like incredibly lovely, elegant, complicated in like just the right ways, but not overburdened in any way. It sounds like it took like either 100 years to write or like 3 seconds, you know? You don't know if it was like worked to the bone or just poured out. But I think that's one of the signs of a really well-written song. Tell me a little bit about this era and when Godspeed arrived, like how was it received?
Godspeed, I think, is a pretty perfect encapsulation of what makes Zach's songwriting so different. I've thought a lot about this, of what makes these songs so interesting. And I feel like what he does is essentially capture, like you said, extremely small moments. I kind of argue that they're like little snow globes in this video I have on my channel called The Suspended Soul of Zach Bryan. Like he suspends these little tiny moments into a full song. And in Godspeed, he's saying, I don't want to go through life too fast. I don't want to go through it too slow. I want to move at Godspeed, at kind of this destined speed at which I'm supposed to be, and kind of appreciate the moment for what it is and who I am and what's around me. Like it's got this kind of weird mix of gratitude and longing. And so I don't know. I think it's very Swiftian, honestly.
Hey, yo, talk that talk, Grady. Talk that talk.
One of the most common frustrated comments on my channel is people being like, stop comparing Zach and Taylor. And I actually made a shirt that says Zwifty, because that's what I consider myself, a Zwifty. And I mean, they both record at Electric Lady Studios, and he's tweeted about this before, but he's a fan of hers as well. And anyway, I think when the Deanne era happened and all those songs dropped, it was, I think we're talking late summer, early fall 2019. And it was this kind of shockwave that went through the, like you said, the Twitterverse, the independent country world. A lot of people were amazed. These songs are very spare. These sound like unfinished demos. They're not well produced, but they're produced well enough. And it's so beautiful and something so disarming about listening to a young man really process his grief and the trauma of losing his mother and his bad attitude about himself, but then these weird glimmers of good attitude about himself. It was just such a real poetic album.
And the Deanne story, you know, he's still in the Navy at that point and he's writing and recording songs at night and on the weekends, you know, when he's not working. And one of his buddies is like, let's get an Airbnb and just go to Guitar Center. You know, we'll buy all the stuff that we need to record an album and we'll just record them over the weekend. And then he, you know, records them, they tighten them up, put them up on streaming services, get your TuneCore account going. And then boom, this man has a career based off of how much attention he had been getting from the Twitter releases and from like the saving country musics of the world and things like that. it's really striking because I don't often think about country music functioning this way. I think of hip hop functioning this way, right? I think of like other forms of pop music functioning this way, but I don't often think of like country or folk or singer songwriter music really moving like this. Was it unusual at that time? Like, how much of an outlier was it?
It was definitely unusual. It's definitely an outlier, but you know, it's kind of become the model, I would say, for a lot of independent artists that are realizing, oh, I don't need a middleman. I can build the hype myself. I can't think of other comparable people at that time in the country world that were doing what he was doing.
Let's take a break and listen to something else from Deanne real quick. This is Snow.
You bring heaven down to me, coursing through my blood as I breathe. I bet the angels are jealous of a girl I know. She takes my stain and makes me white as snow. White as snow.
You bring heaven. Hi, I'm Megan Loram, the director of photography at the New York Times. A photograph can do a lot of different things. It can connect us. It can bring us to places we've never been before. It can capture a story in a universal visual language. But one thing that all these photographs have in common is that, you know, they don't just come out of the ether. We spend a lot of time anticipating news stories, working with the best photographers across the globe. These are photographers who have spent years mastering their technical craft, developing their skills as visual chroniclers of our world. You know, getting certified as a scuba diver and learning how to shoot underwater to document climate change, or tremendous cardiovascular training in order to ski on the slopes next to Olympic athletes. This is an effort that takes tons of time and consideration and resources. All of this is possible only because of New York Times subscribers. If you're not a subscriber yet, you can become one at nytimes.com/subscribe.
We are back. Grady Smith is here. We're talking about Zach Bryan. Having spent a fair amount of time with him in the last like 6 weeks or whatever, I feel fairly confident in saying that maybe this is the only way that it could have happened for him. He is not interested in the mechanisms of the record business, which I know is like a cliche thing to say, but it is, I believe, he comes by that lack of interest honestly. He really seems to be a person who primarily wants to write songs, yell them at and be yelled, have them yelled back at him by 10,000 people, and everything else. Not interested, doesn't care. Even just the process, like he hasn't done press.
Was he annoyed having to talk to you?
No, I mean, I hope not. You'll have to ask him. I think we got along fine, but it was not a gimme. This was not something that was presented to me and said, oh, we have this available to you. This was something I went and I chased. And I think the notion of it, you know, was still kind of a new thing for him. Like, I know he did a little interview with you back in the Deanne era. Maybe did he also talk to Saving Country Music? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, I think Saving Country Music probably got him like a couple of days before I did. And then, but for like years, I was the only on-camera interview of him. And so I appreciated his reticence to speak to press and participate in industry mechanisms, because that video kind of bombed out of the gate. It did well with the core Sad Boys, but over the years, that's one of my biggest videos ever, because there's just not much other content.
Well, I'm sorry I took that from you, Greg.
Yeah, what the heck, man?
Damn, I'm so sorry. My bad. But, you know, to me, this was a person who was having a completely like sui generis breakout, and it needed to be documented.
100%. I've moved to Nashville 2 months ago. I've always kept my distance. I've been full-time on YouTube for 3 years, and I think finally proved myself that I won't sell out. And hell maybe yeah, I could be in the city where I criticize and actually not lose my soul or something. So I'm trying it out. And if I start to lose my soul, I'll move again. But I have talked to a lot of people around town, and still, Zach is a very interesting phenomenon, because country music is often so insular. Nashville often thinks of Nashville as country music, and the people that aren't within that system and aren't kind of playing the songwriting rounds that are at the bars here in town, or going and meeting people that work in radio that are here, they don't even think about them. And so I've talked to some big successful, powerful people. And they're like, who's on your radar? And I'll say, I've been pretty OG on Zach Bryan. I love what he does. And they're like, who's that? Or what, does he have a song at radio or things like that? Now I'm just flabbergasted wondering, how can you not know? I mean, it's been going on for years now. Literally, if you look at sales this year, the top country debut is Luke Combs. I think he started with around 74K with his new album. And then it's Zach Bryan starting with 70K. And so it's a giant thing happening. And I think you're right that it needed to be documented.
We keep talking about country music. And I swear, if Zach Bryan was sitting here, he'd be like hitting me over the head with a plastic bottle. He'd just be like, don't do that. Don't say that. Don't put me in that house. That's not where I live. I don't live there. Who's right? Is he right? What's the deal? Is country radio playing Zach Bryan?
They're starting to. They are starting to. If you look at the country air check and look at the indicator stations, which are usually in smaller markets, he's sitting around like number 40. So in some small markets, he is getting some airplay, and they are officially what's called, and it's so inside baseball, but they're working this single now to country radio.
He is not signed to a Nashville label. He's signed to Warner Maine.
Yes.
Out of LA by the LA people. So he's not signed to the Nashville apparatus. But as people may or may not know, there are radio pluggers or you know, consultants who work, quote unquote, right? And also in-house as well, independent and also in-house, who work or promote singles to radio program directors. So you're saying that is happening with him to country radio?
Yes.
First of all, that in and of itself is fascinating. But do you also think part of that is because where else do you put a guy like him in 2022? Like, what's the other radio option?
I think that's exactly what it is, first of all. But I also think we're kind of seeing people testing these waters. I would say the sonic center of country music has moved quite far from a decade ago. You even have people like Cody Jinks that are paying a promotion team to promote Loud and Heavy, a song of his from 7 years ago that's kind of the crowd favorite, which is this kind of dark rock song, to country radio, and seeing like, let's just see if they'll play it. There's a lot of artists that are kind of experimenting with this right now.
And this is post-bro, post-gentleman, post-hip-hop crossover. Like, you think it reflects a return to something?
100%. Look no further than the type of shirt that Zach Bryan wears up on stage to see that there is a certain kind of Western aesthetic that's not dissimilar to the Brooks and Dunn type shirts or the Garth Brooks type shirts from that sort of golden age of early 90s country that I definitely think is in the air in country music right now. Suddenly, fiddles are back on the radio with, I don't know, Haley Witter's song, Everything She Ain't. John Party is a relevant radio star, and he's never shied away from actual country instrumentation. Even Kelsea Ballerini, the one-time sort of pop princess of country music, has made what is a actually quite country album. And so I just think that, I'm not saying that Zach is necessarily similar to those artists, but I do think if there is a proverbial Overton window of the sound of country music, it is definitely moving more in the direction of kind of what we traditionally think of as country and away from some of the rock and pop.
Should we play what is the Zach Bryan hit right now, which is Something in the Orange, which is not exactly in this space, but is the closest there is to a crossover smash at the moment?
Yes.
All right, this is Something in the Orange. Maybe we'll play ZNE's version.
And I'm damned if I do, and I'm damned if I don't. Cause if I say I miss you, I know that you won't. But I miss you in the mornings when I see the sun.
I find nothing more fatiguing than arguments over genre. Anybody, I think, who is wasting time arguing over the boundaries of a genre doesn't deserve to draw those boundaries, basically.
Excuse you, this is a major part of my entire brand and YouTube channel.
But
so
you know better. I know you know better. Just because you're laying out the terms of the conversation doesn't mean you believe that the conversation should be happening. Yeah. It's okay. You're allowed to talk about it. But like, I know in your heart, you know, it's all nonsense.
I don't think it's fully nonsense. I think it's annoying when artists try to gaslight you into saying, well, this is as country as anything. That's what the band Perry tried to do when they made their whole switch up. And it's definitely, though, more a labeling issue than it is a music issue. I think it's just frustrating sometimes, but I get it. And I understand it's pedantic and annoying.
If we have to look like 3 years, 5 years in the future, are you seeing Zach Bryan on the CMAs?
Ooh, I highly doubt that. I think maybe what you said about Something in the Orange, kind of the where else are we going to put this, is pretty true. It's just such a giant phenomenon that's happening. It's still getting bigger, still moving up the Spotify charts. And it's not even like those kind of, you know, 90s country sounds I was just describing.
No, not at all. Yeah.
It would be still the very, very far outlier within the pastiche of radio. But it's one of those things where it's so big that radio is going to want to be a part of something that is just that huge. Now, whether Zach is going to want to be a part of something that is just that huge, I don't know that we have a lot of evidence to say that he definitely does.
So I'm going to throw out a few like reference points, and we can tackle whichever one seems interesting. Obviously, Sturgill Simpson as a touchstone, both in terms of musical approach and also like music industry refusenik approach, right?
Yes.
Okay, that's one thing. We're just going to put these things on a plate and we'll look at them afterwards. When I think about quote unquote roots music or like roots adjacent music that also was very popular, Lumineers, early Mumford.
Yes.
There is a path towards Z100, which is like the pop station in New York, Z100 type ubiquity, making music that is rootsy in nature. Okay. I don't think he makes songs like that, but it does exist. That's on the plate. I have talked to a number of people about Zach Bryan who are fans who say that he reminds them actually a lot of indie rock, more so than a folk or a country performance. That's on the table. Obviously, Springsteen on the table. To my mind, some of the more interesting sides of Eric Church, that's on the table. Also, a band I love, the Gaslight Anthem, which is a New Jersey kind of like garage punk band. Zach Bryan reminds me a lot of early Gaslight Anthem in terms of detail and emotional acuity. Obviously, the musical arrangements are a little different, but just in terms of like blue collar poetry. I can't believe I just said that phrase, but like a blue collar approach to poetry. I felt like they have a lot in common. Those are all in my mind potential pathways for him.
I would throw Casey into this conversation.
Oh, sure.
Casey Musgraves.
Yeah.
Just of becoming this sort of in the mainstream, but not in the mainstream at the same time, country star. And I think what like all of these people, especially Sturgill, even Tyler Childers with this new album, there is an intense resistance to predictability or to anything that feels contrived. And I think it's probably in the nature of artists like that to, you know, as soon as the CMAs come calling, as soon as Ford wants you to stand in front of a truck and sing a song as you head out to a commercial, they're going to run 100 miles in the opposite direction just to be defiant. And that's what makes them so interesting. Also sometimes confounding or frustrating to certain fan bases. Like there's that one Instagram account called like Where the F*** is Sturgill Simpson? And it's always just because anyone that's followed Sturgill for a long time knows any given day he may or may not have any social media if he's decided to delete it. And Zach's had his phases with that too.
Isn't that just Sturgill's wife? I don't know.
Kind of.
Look, I interview a lot of people. You interview a lot of people. And I interview a lot of people who are on opposite sides of this particular conundrum. I interview people who are just like, I've waited my entire life to get to the dance. I'm at the dance. I'm a dance. Like, I'm doing whatever. I'm with whatever. Like, I'll do the Ford ad. I'll do, like, this is what I've been waiting for. My family is going to eat. My kids, my grandkids are going to have a college fund. Like, yes, I showed up and not have any ambivalence about it, and especially in the 2020s, where, like, outmoded ideas about selling out and so on and so forth just aren't really how most people think anymore. And then you interview the occasional person, like Zach, like Sturgill, whoever, who are just like, I want no parts of this. Like, I genuinely want no parts of this. And I will say, in a lot of my conversation with Zach, he was really leaning in to how opposed to all of this he was, the purity of the act of songwriting, how important that was to him, how crucial it was for him to remain, relatively speaking, independent, to make music on his own terms. This year we did 70 or 80 concerts. Next year we're going to do 30 because he wants to go back to school to finish his bachelor's degree and to get a master's degree. Sometimes you hear people talk like that, and in your heart, you know that they're really not about that life. But I left those conversations feeling extremely convinced that Zach Bryan is about that life. He just was like, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And that's it. That's the extent of it. And that's why there are so many quotes in this story that are basically fundamentally skeptical quotes. Ordinarily, when I'm introducing an artist, like writing at this phase of an artist's career, a lot of the quotes are much more triumphant, right? I finally made it. I can't wait to do more. My dream is to be bigger, things like that, because that's how people tend to approach the early moments of their fame. There's none of that in like the multiple hours of conversation that I had with him. There's none of that anywhere in those conversations. And it's so striking. It's so pure. And it's frankly so 90s, right? It's so 90s.
What do you mean by that? I don't understand.
Okay. I mean, you think about the anxiety of the Kurt Cobain crossover moment. Corporate magazines still suck. And, you know, the tension between leaving an independent label for a major label. And what does that mean for your sound? And what does it mean for the financial burdens and expectations placed on you? That's the last time, and this was true in hip-hop culture as well, people anxiety about, oh, you sampled a Donna Summer record, you sold out, you made a radio hit. No one talks like that anymore. It doesn't exist in hip-hop. It doesn't really exist in rock. Rock is irrelevant. Sorry, Karen. But it doesn't exist in any of these genres. Everybody is content. It's like, oh, if I happen to pop off on TikTok, no big deal. If a commercial wants to use my music, probably it's fine. Whereas in the 90s, those were still active tensions that a lot of musicians emanating from quote-unquote subcultural scenes felt. I almost never talk to a person in the 2020s or even in the late 2010s who feels even remotely tense or stressed about that.
Now, that's interesting because I feel like I have such a different experience. I feel like
because of who you're talking to, probably.
Maybe so. Yeah, I feel like that's probably the main tension like I care about when it comes to music is, and that certainly a lot of my viewers and I think a lot of the country audience seems to care about. And it's probably cyclical, just given the decade that country music had. And we are talking about like peak bro country and all that stuff. And I'm actually not anti bro country in and of itself, but it was the only flavor available. Every single song, every single album was just like trucks and girls and beers and all that stuff. And it became a punchline because it was true. And I think when you maybe have what feels like such a plasticine moment that is so mass produced and just feels so hollow, there has been a real drive to kind of get back to good music, to get back to nuanced lyrics, to kind of dive into people that are doing it without the mainstream, because I think a lot of people feel, well, the mainstream sold us out and it wasn't giving us anything good. And I think a huge part of passion behind artists like Zach is the outsider nature, their skepticism of the kind of corporate music world. I think people trust that and it matters to them. Does that make sense?
It does. But I wonder, like, you perceive in the category of musicians that you cover thoroughly, do you perceive this degree of anxiety about the purity of the art? Maybe I'm the sellout.
Well, look, we're coming from different places. Like, I'm here on a New York Times podcast, but I left the media and probably have like some chip on my shoulder to what
you're
I view as.
You're like Zach Bryan. You're the Zach Bryan of country music YouTube.
Maybe so. You know, I think that is, it's interesting to me that he wanted to come on the channel. And like, that's, and that is very much kind of been my perspective. So I don't know. I think it is a growing sentiment in music. I certainly don't think it's the main driver of most artists, but I definitely hear it in the words of a lot of these people that are country adjacent. I think that's a good term. There is that built-in anxiety about not wanting to sell out, not wanting to, and I don't think it's actually just in country music at all. I hear a lot of the TikTokers, a lot of whom have nothing to do with country, expressing something similar of like, why would I give away my masters? Why would I sign with a big label? I have my own audience.
Okay. Yes. I think that there's a lot more awareness of the power of independence and financial independence. But I wonder if the difference is a lot of these people maybe have not had to directly reckon with a financial windfall. They're not courting audiences of several thousand people a night. Like, I think it's one thing to kind of live on the margins and advocate for living on the margins. It's another thing to like barrel straight into the centrist headwinds and still be advocating for life on the margins.
And yeah, maybe that's what's interesting about Zach, is because he's doing both at the same time, like doing a big feature. That's a step in a willingness to kind of play ball. There is a way in which I think artists, as a coping mechanism, almost have to maintain their skepticism, have to maintain the bubble of wonder around them when they are skyrocketing through the atmosphere, or else it would just be too much to handle when you're getting that famous that quickly. And even when you are starting to participate in some of the machinations of the industry, you certainly don't want to embrace them outright.
Let's talk a little bit more, as we're kind of getting towards the end of the conversation. I feel like we haven't talked loads about the music, surprisingly. Yeah. Give me a song off Heartbreak that you really like.
Ooh, well, I mean, exactly what we're talking about is If She Wants a Cowboy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. All right, let's get it in. If She Wants a Cowboy, Zach Bryan.
She wants a cowboy, so I just might find me some boots that fit me right. Chew some tobacco, ride me a bronco on a southern Saturday night. I ain't ever rode a horse.
Now, does she want a cowboy? What? Let's be honest. Is that really what she wants? Talk to me about this record.
Okay, this song's hilarious.
So
because
funny. So good. Such a good song.
Such a good song. And it's a weird mix of things. It's not just about like fickle young love. It also ends up making a statement about Nashville. And he goes into a whole auto-tuned section of, you know, when the girl turns out that she doesn't actually want a cowboy that ropes and rides. She just wants like a Nashville cowboy in aesthetics. It goes into this whole ridiculous overproduced section. But yeah, that song's super funny. That's one of my favorites off Heartbreak, but definitely an outlier within that album.
It is, but I don't find it to be a kind of like spiritual or philosophical outlier, but it is an outlier in how that spirit is rendered.
100%. It's like the fun version of Cold Damn Vampires.
Yes, very much so. A song that I want to talk about is Happy Instead.
Interesting.
Let's listen to that.
You called last night and my child up and jumped. He asked who you were and you did the same. Handed me the phone and I couldn't recall your name. What if I said happy instead?
First of all, this song hit me very hard during a challenging little stretch of my summer. The power of him writing from the perspective of knowing that he is not the right person for the other protagonist in this song, and how this person basically doesn't want to be bothered. Like, basically, he would only be a disruption to that person. It's written so beautifully and so cleanly, but also, even though it's rooted in a kind of disappointment, it's such a hopeful song. The chords, the arrangement, it feels almost jaunty, but it's so sad on a lyrical level. And I just admire the hell out of it. Really, really hits very hard.
That little weird tension of sadness and hope is all shook up in Amazing Jar on a Zach Bryan song. I heard someone say once that people misunderstand some types of music when they hear sad music and they think it's just sad, but you don't bother to feel so sad about everything if there's not some more hopeful version of life that you on some level believe you could be achieving. And otherwise, what would be the point of feeling sad about it? And I feel like Happy Instead is a good example of that.
Incredible record. Played it 100 times this summer for easily.
That's so interesting. I haven't heard anyone say, I mean, the ones people always shout are Heavy Eyes. That's like when you're with the boys, like that's the one they're going to scream the loudest at a Zach show. I would say. But that from this record, that's the one I hear about the most. Man, there's so many good ones that I love. I'm into Tisha Mingo.
Whiskey Fever.
Okay. It's a rollicking jam. Billy Stay. Speaking of Swiftian, I would say that in the same way that she wrote a letter, I believe, ahead of Reputation. It was in one of those Target exclusive magazine type things. And it was essentially saying, I'm not always being autobiographical, and I feel like I'm often reduced down to always telling stories about myself, but sometimes I'm just telling stories as a storyteller. That's a reduction of what she wrote, but that was the sense of it. And Zach definitely does that too. There's some songs like Billy Stay where he is writing from the perspective of like an Alzheimer's patient and wanting to just for a moment, he's writing from a woman's perspective and wanting to remember her lover, Billy. It's just so different and interesting and weird.
We talked about him doing character work, that obviously that there are songs that where he is not the protagonist, and that in a way he said the EP was maybe even a little bit more character work, a higher percentage of character work than on the album. The EP is Summertime Blues, or this EP that came out afterwards, and there is some autobiography on this, or at least things that approach autobiography, such as Motorcycle Drive-By. I opened my story with the scene of him a couple weeks after Heartbreak comes out. It's a big success. He's taking a little bit of break from the road. He's with his girlfriend. They're having a beautiful day. And then the next day, they're on his motorcycle, and he crashes out, and he gets pretty badly injured. You know, that Richmond show that I was at, and you were also at.
And Green. I was at, yeah.
Yeah. That was his
that first, just happened.
That Jeez. Was his first show back after the motorcycle accident. I think it was within maybe 4 days, 5 days of the accident.
And that was the gossip in the crowd. I was there with my father and my best friend because our other friend dropped out for his new girlfriend. So I was like, Dad, you want to come to the show with us? And so we went and saw that. But the gossip in the crowd was like, why is he wearing sunglasses? What's going on? And he sings about that on the record. He sings about the people in Richmond want to hear me sing my songs under lights, but he's feeling so ashamed of himself at the same time.
Just based on the conversations we were having, it's very humbling. You're on top of the world. And also, it sounds, you know, he's been riding motorcycles since he was like 14 or 13 or whatever, you know, to be on top of the world and then to have something like that happen, I think was obviously deeply humbling and troubling that it could all truly just go away in a second, could just be gone. But yeah, that day in Richmond, he was wearing sunglasses. And also, he had a bandage on one of his arms, I believe, from, if I remember the detail correctly, I think his brake pedal basically went through or was inserted into his arm. I mean, it just, you know, imagine how much worse this all could have been. Really, really, I think, caused him to reflect and really just, if he was already mentally committed to like, hey, I need to like create more space for myself and also like a more manageable version of my career, I think having a kind of like near-death experience with your partner, your girlfriend, also going through it with you, you know, that just, that'll shore up that desire for certain.
The chemistry of that evening, I've gone to a lot of freaking shows in my life. That is easily the most electric evening I've ever been to at a concert.
Wild night. The thunderstorm that night?
Well, it was like heat storming and everyone was parked just in a giant field. And you don't actually have the opportunity to kind of, or you weren't supposed to have the opportunity to really tailgate. But basically, they wouldn't let anyone into the venue. And it was up in the air for about 3 hours if the show was going to happen. So everyone stuck around. The cops even let people go and get beer and stuff and come back in, which normally you wouldn't be allowed to do. So everyone was so fired up or it had a lot of alcohol. No one kind of knew if the show was going to happen. So then when they finally at the last second were like, come in, everyone poured in and the opener, poor Charles Wesley Godwin, only got to play like 3 or 4 songs or something. But then, man, everyone screaming every lyric and all the backdrop of the storm. Everyone's a little wet. We'd all been in this together. Zach was maybe feeling some type of way from the accident. It just created a truly insane evening. I loved it. Probably my favorite show I've ever been to.
Really, really intense and special night. You know, I saw him there and then I went to Indianapolis just from a timing perspective. That's where it made sense to go and do the bulk of the interviewing for the story. And I watched the Richmond show side stage. So you kind of see the crowd, but you're also not in the crowd, right? Indianapolis, I watched from the middle of the crowd. And boy, That was more powerful, just more powerful, really, really intense. And I know we're just two guys sitting on a podcast talking about watching other guys sing along to another guy. I know. I understand it's silly. I understand that it's a narrow slice of the global experience. But having been through a lot of these narrow slices in my day, it was very special.
I'm pumped that Zach has become such a big fan and supporter of Charles Wesley Godwin, who's been essentially like his permanent opener this whole year. Charles's two albums have both been in my top two for the years that they were released. And his band, the Allegheny High, is incredible. And I don't know, it just makes me happy that I think a lot of people are starting to realize, oh my gosh, this guy's voice is one of a kind. His writing is really unusual and cool. So I'm just excited about this friendship.
Let's go out with maybe my favorite Zach Bryan song. It's tough to say. There's a lot of really great ones, but we're going to go out at the end with Oklahoma Smoke Show. This song reminds me so much of that early Casey Musgrave song. You know what I'm talking about.
Merry-Go-Round?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Reminds me of that. It's a darker record. There's the undercurrent of the threat of violence in this record. It's cold. This is a cold record, but the conundrum at its core.
No one can reject you like your hometown can.
That's exactly right. And no one can understand how limiting a hometown could be than someone who got out. And that's something that I think Zach Bryan is reckoning with actively in his life and also in his music. So we'll play Oklahoma Smoke Show as we're going out. That's our show. Thank you to Grady Smith. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us podcast@nytimes.com. Shirts, check the Facebook group. That's all I'm going to say. Check the Facebook group, check the Discord. Shirts, they're there, or they will be. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content. That's Google, Apple, Stitcher, et cetera, et cetera. Get in the Facebook group, tinyurl.com/podcast. Facebook. tinyurl.com/podcast. Discord for the Discord. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado. Pedro, it's our first episode back after the live show. I'm getting used to being at my desk again. I want to say again, thank you to everybody who came to the live show. Thank you to Gertie for hosting us. It was, I don't want to get too emotional, but it exceeded all my expectations. I couldn't have been happier. The only way I could have been happier is if we had 200 or 300 people there. And maybe next time we will. Think face emoji. Just one to grow on. But again, if you came to it, thank you. It was great to meet everybody. And if you listened to it, hopefully you felt the kind of palpable energy in the room. A really great time. That's our episode this week. This is Oklahoma Smoke Show.
Them boys are out and they're angry and they're looking for blood in the back of a blue old pickup truck. You've got nowhere to go, although you're all gussied up. There's so much whiskey in his coke, it'll make her nose spin. But she swears it is love, it's a damn godsend.